This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, in for Terry Gross, who's still a little bit under the weather. She hopes to return tomorrow. Our guest today is George Lucas. As creator of the Star Wars movies and universe, he launched a franchise whose impact on pop culture and on Hollywood marketing and technology, that's immeasurable. Industrial Light and Magic, his special effects production house, has pioneered one cinematic revolution after another. The list of films he has directed and or produced includes, among many others, American Graffiti and the Indiana Jones movies. His newest project, though, is a book, George Lucas's Blockbusting, a behind-the-scenes history of movies. The top 300 films from the beginning of the cinema to 2005 that Lucas himself considers most timeless and significant. His definition of a blockbuster includes such things as artistic merit and lasting cultural impact, which makes his list both personal and interesting. In addition, Lucas and his researchers have gathered an amazing amount of information about original budgets, shooting schedules, production problems, and other aspects of the business of show business. They've also adjusted for inflation all the original box office figures, production budgets, and ticket prices, which makes for plenty of amazing comparisons. For example, George Lucas's list of the 10 most popular movies in history isn't your standard list of today's biggest blockbusters. Adjusted to modern dollars, the 1939 film Gone with the Wind remains the most popular film ever, followed by the original entry in Lucas's own Star Wars saga. The rest of the top 10? The Sound of Music, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, The Ten Commandments, Titanic, Jaws, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Ben-Hur, and The Exorcist. George Lucas, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
You have in your book 300 movies, and you chose them. And I love most of the choices in your book, things that I didn't necessarily think were going to get in there that did. Dr. Strangelove, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Deliverance. I regret the absence of one film, and so I have to ask you about this. It's Gold Diggers of 1933.
Mm.
And I don't know if that was a borderline thing, and I wondered – not only why isn't that there, but also which movie do you miss? Which one for you was number 301?
Well, it's not 301. It's sort of 1001. the hard part was, you know, culling it down and trying to find a mix of movies that run the gamut of different kinds of genres, different kinds of success. This book is as accurate as I could possibly make it. We had a lot of researchers. They worked many years. Some of the films that we picked, we just couldn't get any information on. I mean, I just couldn't find out anything. So we had those drop by the wayside. So a lot of the films that I wanted in there didn't get in there just because we didn't have any information about it, which is one of the reasons I was so anxious to do this book, because there's a lot of information out there, and the studios are going through their changes and all their things from corporate realities from this and that. And a lot of this information is disappearing.
Right. There's no institutional memory.
Yeah, and the people. We actually were able to talk to some people who actually lived through a lot of this, and we were able to they still have some of this stuff on file in a musty old vault somewhere at the bottom or basement. Warehouse somewhere that somebody knew about that we could get into and find out the facts. So that's going to go away in probably another 20 or 30 years. This information won't be there anymore. Now, we're also in a process right now of completely turning this business model, the technology, and everything on its head. So this, what's in this book now, is suddenly becoming ancient history. Simply by the technological advances that we're going through and the revolution. And so that's one other reason why I wanted to preserve it.
So why no Gold Diggers of 1933?
Well, I think no Gold Diggers of 1933 was that each year we have a limit on how many we can put in there. And I think I just couldn't fit it in. I mean, again, I wanted Gold Diggers in 1930. You'll see there's a little section on musicals and hits of the 20s.
Oh, yeah.
And
no,
it's in there.
It's in there.
And it's, you can't include everything.
Which blockbuster on your list most influenced you as a youngster? What was your favorite film-going experience among those movies?
Well, when I was very young, I didn't really go to the movies that much, to be very honest with you.
Really?
And even when I did, I was, you know, as a teenager, I was more chasing girls than I was actually watching movies. It wasn't until I actually got to film school that I actually – and I wasn't interested in Hollywood. I was more interested in art films in San Francisco, you know, Bruce Bailey and those kind of off-the-track people.
Had an oh-wow childhood experience in a movie theater?
Mm-mm. Mm-mm. Well, I mean, I saw Ben-Hur was an oh-wow experience when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And so was Lawrence of Arabia. Those are ones that would stick with me. Once I got to film school and I had things like Dr. Strangelove was my favorite movie, which is why it's in there.
Oh, good.
And several movies like that.
It's one of those movies that gets better every time you see it. I even know what that phenomenon is, but you see more, it seems smarter, it seems more relevant the older it gets.
Well, I've actually experienced just the opposite, which is we have passed it. So the sense of satire has disappeared. Because the real world we live in is so much more goofy and stupid than the one portrayed in that movie. I know it's very depressing.
But it's probably accurate, though. It's okay. One of the things that's in this book I should describe to people, that there's all these charts, there's all these lists, there's all these little side things. And then each film is described. And then there are stories and showbiz stories and financial stories. And you find out these interesting little factoids all the way through. I didn't know, for example, that Meg Ryan and Molly Ringwald were up for Pretty Woman before Julia Roberts got it, or that Butch Cassidy is the number one Western of all time.
Right. Well, there's a lot of mythology around the movie business, and this pretty much pokes a hole in all of it, because was the point of the book, to say, all right, let's remove all the hype and let's just get down to the raw facts. And they're more fascinating personally, I think, than the hype is. I mean, there's things, you know, I even learned things. I mean, in 1910, the average ticket price was $6 or $6.50. Today, the average ticket price is $6.50. You know, I just made my assumptions based like everybody else does, but the cost of a ticket hasn't changed at mm-hmm. all. You know, obviously in the big cities it's more and in the small towns it's less. But the average is pretty much the same as it was back in, 1920.
One cost that I'm sure has gone up, the music rights for American Graffiti in this book. Because I've always wondered about that, because American Graffiti was your movie. It really started the nostalgia music craze, and you were able to get what was then a two album, but I guess a two CD or just a two-album set of songs, 40 songs, for $80,000. Now, what do you think that would cost you today?
Well, that's not actually what happened. When we did the movie, it was a very low-budget movie, $700,000. And they said the music budget can't be over 10% of the movie. And of course, nobody wanted me to do that. They said, you can't just put that much music in a movie. It won't work. And you have to score it. You can't just throw songs on it. It's not going to work. It's because nobody had ever done it before. So I did it. We made the movie. We put the music in there. It was $70,000. And at the time, we said, look, for another $5,000 per song, we can get you the record rights to this. And they said, no, we don't want any record rights. We don't want anything. And then they came back a year later. And again, we were bringing these, nobody knew who the owners of these songs were and all kinds of things, because it was, real about a period of music where there wasn't much organization. And sometimes we'd go to people who had records in their garage and the rights, and the masters and everything. So a year later, the studio went to do an album after the film was a giant hit, and it cost them $1 million.
Really?
For those same songs. that I got for $70,000.
Wow.
So that gives you a clue of where it went just in 1 year.
So now I have some blockbuster questions. the audience experience of a blockbuster, I'm not talking about the wider definition that you've done in the book, but the sort of thing that we think of where they make tons of money, they're very big spectacle films. I think of like Jaws, where I sat in the back of an audience once and saw everybody kicking at the same time to avoid being slid down like Quint in the shark's mouth, or going right up the stairs of The Exorcist and everybody screaming at once. How important is that communal viewing experience as we move forward?
I think that is very, very important, and I think that's the key to why movie theaters and the movie-going experience in a theater will never die. I always tell people, I say, look, as long as Green Bay Packer fans go in the 70 below zero weather in the snow to watch a game they can't actually see because they all want to be together and scream together and have a good time together, the movie industry is safe. And there will always be movie theaters. There'll always be people that want that social experience because people, human beings, are a social animal. And they will want something like the opera, like the ballet. You know, they will want to go and have this communal motion picture experience, or like plays and Broadway shows. So I don't think that's ever going to go away. And I think in the end, the movie theaters are being are going to become more accommodating to that idea that it needs to be a special experience, a special communal experience, which means better quality theaters, bigger screens, more amenities, so that it's a real experience.
Does it necessarily mean more spectacle, or would there still be room for an American Graffiti along with a Star Wars?
I have a feeling that the American Graffitis are going to probably go by the wayside in terms of theatrical release. I think they're going to go directly to pay-per-view, you know, which is sort of internet-based distribution.
One theme of your book is how technology changes things in Hollywood every so often. You know, sound, color, widescreen, Dolby, CGI. Can you tell us about tomorrow? You're so well placed to do this. Is it 3D? Is it something else? What's going on at Industrial Light and Magic that's really exciting you?
Well, the breakthrough at Industrial Light and Magic really was Jurassic Park. That was when we finally got a 3D animated character of a dinosaur to look real. And, you know, that's from the very, very beginning of the movie industry, whether it's Millais' Trip to the Moon or, you know, Lost World. People have been struggling with these issues. And we finally did it. Now you can do anything. I mean, literally you can do anything. And obviously we can do it quicker and faster and easier and that sort of thing. And that's going to continue. 3D is the new kid on the block. The thing I like about the new 3D as opposed to the old 3D, old 3D were 3D movies, you know, where they took spears and poked them in the audience's eyes and stuff. Now we're shifting that. And even though there's a little of that left, mostly movies now are movies in 3D. And we, very early on in this process, we experimented with turning Episode 4 into a 3D movie. And with Jim Cameron and Bob Zemeckis and I, we went to the Theater Owners Convention in Las Vegas and we showed these 3D movies and saying, you've got to go digital because if you go digital, we can have 3D movies and these are what they look like. The startling thing about that is everything we showed them, especially like Star Wars, which was not designed to be a 3D movie, it just was a different way of looking at the movie. It was cleaner. It had depth. You know, it just looked great. But you didn't – you know, after a while, you forget that it's in 3D. It just it doesn't come out and remind you.
Before the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, before you did that, what were the pre-digital special effects that you think were most significant, whether it was the Steadicam or some sort of process stuff that hadn't been done before? What movies really worked for you in a pre-digital age?
Well, in a pre-digital age, we had matte paintings, which, you know, were when you wanted a big wide shot of something, especially a period film. And they were very static, but they seemed to work in the movies all right. And the special effects part has been there ever since the very, very beginning, you know, since the trip to the moon, mm-hmm. which was very crude. But when you get to then to King Kong, which was the beginning of stop motion animation, they improved it, but it was basically the same thing. And when I did – I mean the number one movie up to that point really was 2001, where they took a great deal of care, spent a huge amount of money, a vast amount of time, and they made these perfect shots of, you know, spaceships floating through space.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very slow and very meticulous. I wanted to make a movie that was very fast and kinetic. So I set my sights on one technological advance that I needed in order to make the film move fast and have a lot of energy and be able to be an editorialized movie rather than a bunch of set static shot movie, which is what 2001 was, the ultimate special effects movie since the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we did. We figured out how to take models and match backgrounds and so shoot them where you could pan through space, which you couldn't do at that point. You could move the camera. So we were able to move the camera. That was a major breakthrough. The second movie, I decided that what I would try to do is create a realistic, so you believed it was a real person, 2-foot green guy, which, you know, you say, well, gee. But, you know, in those days, that was impossible. You just couldn't do it. And the idea was that unless you did it with stop motion. But in stop motion, it was very hard to do acting. You know, they did a lot of things in the acting, but the acting was very, very crude. But to do a more sophisticated form of acting, we made the decision to go to puppets. And we were just beginning to get to that place where we could use servo motors and other kinds of technologies mm-hmm. to move the eyes and move the skin and do things that you couldn't do before. And that was our technological breakthrough. But those were things that had kind of been around, you know, rubber masks and, you know, elaborate makeup and stop motion and matte paintings. And it really wasn't until digital that it blew all that open so that you could do anything.
Nowadays, it's not that hard to see a blockbuster coming. You know, you'll hear about something like Titanic or Avatar a long time before it actually comes into theaters and you have these expectations. But Star Wars was a really different animal. And can you talk about when you gave a first private screening for some of your filmmaking friends and your other friends? Do you remember what their reaction was?
Well, I come up into the film business from film school, and as a result, I have a lot of friends who are filmmakers who went to school with me or were going to school at the same time I was. In those days, which was in sort of the 60s, you couldn't get into the film business. So there was absolutely zero chance of us making it in the film business because you had to be related to somebody. So there was no chance of us ever, ever making it in the film business. None of us even thought that that would happen. But we loved movies. We loved making movies. And we cooperated with each other. We're helping each other. We were like, you know, rebels trying to work our way in somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So we continued that. We always helped each other. We always cooperated with each other. And we would screen our movies in a rough cut to each other to get everybody's advice. When I did that with Star Wars, it was in really rough shape, and I invited a few friends. Some of them didn't understand it. It was very rough. And some of them, like Steve Spielberg, said, this is going to be the biggest hit of all time.
Does he know? Yeah.
Yeah. And some friends like Brian De Palma said, you know, what's this crazy Force stuff and why isn't there more blood? And, you know, I know my friends really well
mm-hmm.
and I know what their reactions to things are. You know, everybody is personal and they're all very honest. I mean, the great thing about having friends watch your movie is they give it to you, which is what you want. That's mm-hmm. why they're seeing it. So I got a very mixed result. The ones that really didn't understand it were just very quiet and said, I'm not sure about this one. But generally, you know, everybody sort of made contributions to what I could do to improve it, what wasn't working, what didn't make sense, and that sort of thing. which is what I expected. The first time I showed it to an audience, obviously they went nuts. And
that must have been great.
It was. I mean, it was the same thing with American Graffiti. You know, we showed the movie of American Graffiti and people just started screaming and yelling and getting carried away. And, you know, my first film, THX, everybody was very quiet afterwards.
One story about your filmmaking friends in your earlier days, and I don't know that this is true, but I'd like to confirm it if I can because I think it's a wonderful story, that you and Steven Spielberg at one point in your careers each thought that the other one was coming out with a blockbuster, and so you traded points so that you would actually have some sort of a financial remuneration from the other's film in case the other one did better. Is that true?
Yeah, that is true, actually. I mean, we were – in those days, you know, it was the 60s. And it was a different world. It was sort of a communal world where everybody helped each other. Everybody encouraged everybody. Everybody shared with everybody. And we did it that way. Of course, you know, none of us knew these films were going to be hits.
Well, that's what
I mean,
love
Steve,
about it. Yeah.
Steve may have come out ahead because he said, I know this is going to be a hit. I certainly didn't know it was a hit. So,
what films are we talking about here?
Well, that was The Close Encounters and Star Wars.
not a bad couple of films to throw money around on a bet.
Yeah. Well, in the end, it was, you know, I thought he had the better film and he thought I had the better film and he won. I had the better film.
I think that's great. When you were with friends and you were all seeing early screenings, rough cuts or very rough cuts of one another's films, what memories do you have? What really stands out about seeing some of those films by your friends?
Well, that was a great time for me and I think for all my friends. You know, for 10 or 15 years, we would show each other our movies and – you know, we'd sit down on the editing machine. We'd go through them with them. We'd see the screenings. It was a very collaborative and fun period. And I think we all have very, very fond memories of all that. It was like a film commune. And it was, you know, as it turns out, all of the sort of players, you know, from Francis Coppola to Marty Scorsese to Steve Spielberg, it's just, you know, and more. We didn't think that we were going to be the old men of the industry, but it turned out that way, that we actually are the ones who were able to rise above the average. And I think part of it was because we were able to help each other and we had support from each other.
But one movies in particular, when you were seeing these things, before anybody else was seeing them, before they were even finished, what really popped out by whom?
Well, Godfather was a real experience because the movie originally was very, very long and we got to see it and it was great. It was really great. And then the studio sort of made him cut it really, really short and it didn't work at all. But he turned that in and then they eventually let him cut it back long again. But seeing the first cut of that was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the first cut of Taxi Driver, which was quite an experience. Because it was pretty intense and it was sort of pushing the boundaries of violence and story and all kinds of things. So that was really exciting. What else was there? There was Jaws was, you know, because we lived through that.
What do you mean you lived through that?
Well, Steven had a lot of problems making that movie. I mean, it was on water. It was very, very, very difficult. So there was a lot of pain and suffering that went on in that movie. And, you know, it's – so we heard the day-to-day drama and then I saw the movie. And that was very exciting because it worked like crazy. And he's – after all the struggle and all the – you get those movies where you say this is going to be the biggest disaster ever. And everybody thinks it. You know, because it was so hard to make and there were so many things that went wrong. And,
mm-hmm.
and then when you see it and it works like works, you just say, wow, that's fantastic. It just, you know. And I think ultimately it was the same way for the people that saw Star Wars, which is, well, this is, you know, because it didn't have any special effects in it at all. And they just said, I don't understand this movie. And it was the same thing with the studio when they read the script.
It's hard to visualize Star Wars with no special effects.
And the studio, when they read the scripts, they said, I don't understand the movie. I don't know what it is. I don't get it. And it's not until it all falls together in one piece and you got the sound and the picture together and it's all working that it actually is a movie. And I think a lot of people don't understand that a movie ultimately is a very fragile thing. And that, you know, if it's not put together right and it's not finished right, they can fall apart. It doesn't take a lot to send it the wrong way.
You've talked about how important that storytelling is as you define blockbusters and blockbusting, that there has to be an emotional resonance to these films for you to have put them into your list of these 300 movies through the ages. Can you talk about mythology? Because here we have Avatar that's out as we speak, and it's reworking Native American stories for part of its inspiration. And Star Wars was all about absorbing and reflecting various world myths and the whole Joseph Campbell perspective. And they were rewarded financially and every other way for dipping into mythology. Do epic blockbusters and mythology go hand in hand in film?
Well, mythology basically is storytelling. And when I started out in college, I was an anthropology major, and that's where I first became acquainted with mythology. And I always thought of mythology as psychological archaeology. You know, the regular anthropology, you can sort of, especially in terms of if you go back into society and archaeology, you get a sense of the way the society worked and everything, but you don't get a sense of what they were thinking. With the stories, with the mythology, you get a sense of what they were thinking. And by getting a sense of what they're thinking, you get a sense of their psychology, of mm-hmm. what the social psychology and sometimes the individual psychology. And that's what fascinated me, because I've been very interested in that all my life. And the reason I got involved in Star Wars in the first place is mm-hmm. I wanted to do a little experiment with myself to see if the myths that were told and the psychological motifs that underlying those myths were still relevant today, if we still reacted to the same psychology that they did back then. So I didn't sort of take myths and turn them into a movie and modern and update them and everything. What I did is I took the psychology behind the myths, and then I also went, which is where Joe Campbell came in, which is he was a comparative mythologist, and he would go across all various cultures, time periods, and that sort of thing, and find the things that were common. I was very interested in that, so I took the same things that were common, and I used those as the basis for my story, and discovered, I think, that beyond a doubt, we have the same psychology that we had 3,000 years ago. We don't have the same intellect. We have advanced a huge amount in the last 3,000.
Oh, I didn't know which way you were going to go with that.
But in the psychological motifs of what we do, why we do it, our psychology as an animal hasn't changed much. And we're still in the drama of trying to adapt to sort of hyper environmental situations that are putting extra strain on our psychology, which existed then, but not that much different, but in different ways.
George Lucas, thank you very much for being on Fresh Air.
It's my pleasure.
Filmmaker George Lucas. His new book, George Lucas's Blockbusting, has just been published. This is Fresh Air. Today we remember Willie Mitchell, the trumpeter and record producer who owned High Records of Memphis and recorded hits by, among others, Al Green, including this one.
Love and happiness, yeah, something that can make you do wrong, make you do right, yeah. Love. Love and happiness. But wait a minute, something's going wrong. Someone's on the phone, 3 o'clock in the morning, yeah, talking about how she can make it right, yeah, yeah. happiness is when you really feel good about somebody. There's nothing wrong being in love with someone, yeah. Oh, baby, love and happiness.
That was Love and Happiness by Al Green, produced by Willie Mitchell. Mitchell died yesterday, 2 weeks after suffering a cardiac arrest. He was 81. Today, we'll play back interviews Terry Gross recorded with Willie Mitchell and with Al Green. In 1991, Al Green told Terry how he met Willie Mitchell.
I met him in the country out in Midland, Texas, in Odessa, Texas, out there. I met him out there. He asked me about going to Memphis to sing on a recording because he worked at a studio. And we were riding in the car that day, and I said, how long do you think it'll take me? I was so flamboyant, I don't understand how I did it. I was riding with this guy, and I says, how long will it take me to become a star? He says, and he swallowed and like choked, right? He says, a star? Well, about 2 years probably if you really work at it. I said, excuse me, let me out. I don't have any kind of time. He says, you're not serious. I said, I'm serious. I don't have 2 years to waste on practicing to become a star. I need some money now. And really, so he took me down to high. He says, this kid's going to be phenomenal. They says, how do you know that? He says, because he's got it in him. And so he borrowed $1,500 for me from the president of the company to get me a place to stay and all that, and says, I want to work with him because he's going to be phenomenal. Just watch.
Gee, it really pays to have chutzpah, huh?
I guess I just told him I wanted to be what I wanted to be.
Now the first song that he asked you to record was a cover of the Beatles' "I Want to Hold Your Hand," right?
Would you believe that?
It really is hard to believe. Why did he choose that?
I have no idea.
What was your reaction to it?
My reaction was good. I thought it was a great song. It was a wonderful song, but it was for the Beatles. I sung "I Want to Hold Your Hand." I sung "Driving Wheel." We was trying to find Al Green. That's what we was trying to find. Who is this guy? Who is this guy with the high falsetto and the rough voice? And Willie says, I tell you what, don't sing with the rough voice. I said, well, what do you want me to do? He's cutting all these different songs about different people, just a lot of songs. He says, sing mellow. Don't sing hard, sing mellow. And I just went out there and started singing, I'm so tired of being alone. And I'm so tired of on my own. Help me, girl, as soon as you can. And I looked in the studio mirror. They have this glass, right? And you're looking at the engineers. Yeah. And everybody was jumping up and jumping up and jumping up. And I says, well, I must be doing something right. So I just keep on saying, people say. And that's, I don't know how that started. That's the way it started.
Well, that was your song. It was a song you wrote. So you already had it written.
Yeah, after we got done cutting all these other people's songs, the Beatles and all these blues songs and the Temptations, I Can't Get Next to You and all these songs, I says, I got a song too. So Willie says, oh, please. Because he'd been cutting all day. We'd been cutting all day. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. I says, I got me a song and I wrote it on my own. So Willie told one of the guys, go out there and see what he got, would you please? I got to have a drink. Willie had a little shot of vodka or something. And after he went to feeling better, he says, all right, what we got out here? And it was this song, Tired of Being Alone. And I worked it up with the band. And I sung it, and it became our first million seller.
Well, I'm going to play it.
Let's play it. Come on. Let's play it.
This is Al Green's first big hit, a song he wrote, Tired of Being Alone.
People say that I found a way.
That's Tired of Being Alone by Al Green, produced by Willie Mitchell. Now let's listen to a bit of Terry's conversation with Willie Mitchell from 1995.
Tired of Being Alone, is that the recording that you think really established his sound, both as a songwriter and a singer, and maybe your sound as a producer as well?
Right. I think that was the beginning.
This has not only great singing, but it has a great arrangement behind him. Did you do the arrangement yourself?
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about what went into that arrangement, into the horns and the backup singers?
Well, I used to be a jazz player, and we always used strange chords, not regular chords that other people use. And I think we had some minor nines in there that people weren't using then. So the arrangement was built on chords that really weren't used in R&B records.
More of jazz chords?
More jazz chords, right.
What about the backup singers that come in? How did you decide to use backup singers, and what kind of sound were you looking for in those singers?
Well, you're speaking of Don and Sandra Rhodes. They used to have a country show. They come on every Saturday, and I'd watch them. And they was like 16, 17 years old. And we had the studio way over in the ghetto, so I called their mother and I said, your children have really good sound with their voice. I said, I'd like to come over to the studio and work with them. She said, I don't know about that. But anyway, sooner or later they came to the studio, Donna and Sandra Rhodes, and we began to do some background on different things, and they sounded great. And I loved the sound. They went to the Bee Gees. They sang for everybody. Frank Sinatra and everybody.
Now, I'm surprised that the singers that first captured your attention were country singers.
What's the sound they had? It's the sound they had. I was trying to really do something that no one else had done in Memphis. And once I put that together and put the right musicians together, I had a sound that was different, but still had feel to it.
You said you were putting together a sound nobody else had done before. What was different about your sound?
Well, we're speaking of the Al Green things. I was trying to get Al Green to sound jazzy on top and softer, and the band to be thunder on the bottom of it and pretty in the middle. And that's what Don and Summer, Don and Rose and them done. They were pretty in the middle, and we had Al Jackson on drums, and it was thundering out of the bottom, and Al was on top doing jazz chords and everything. So that was the difference.
Now, you grew up in Memphis, right?
Right.
What kind of music did you hear when you were growing up?
A whole lot of bebop music. Everybody wanted to be Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, including myself. Then there was a guy came from Chicago. He lived in Memphis, named Unger Horn. He went to school with Quincy Jones and Billy Strayhorn. He came to Memphis. He changed the whole picture of music in Memphis. He organized a big band, and this guy was so great. He one of my idols. He taught me everything. In fact, that's his arrangement on Cher for Isaac Hayes.
Oh, really? That's a great... I love that arrangement.
Yeah, that's... Unger Horn, he passed away a while back.
So he taught you a lot about arranging.
Oh, yeah. He taught me everything.
Willie Mitchell, how did you first join Hi Records?
Oh, that's funny. I had a real popular band in Memphis. We used to work at in Arkansas, across the river.
Mm-hmm.
A club called Danny's Club. And it became real famous because Bill Black used to come in, Elvis would come in.
Yeah, Bill Black used to play with Elvis.
Yeah, he was his bass player. So they decided to make a record with High Records. And I had a piano player named Joe Hall. He was real good. And they wanted to use him. So I carried him to High. And they made a record called Smokey Part 2. And it was a big seller. And after that, they were trying to come up with other hit records. They couldn't do it, so they called me, and I became Bill Black's arranger. And that's how I got into High.
So you started recording your own band at High Records.
Right.
You did mostly instrumentals. In fact, why don't we hear one of the instrumentals you recorded? This was Soul Serenade, which was a hit for you in 1968.
Right.
It's one of your compositions. Why don't we hear it?
Good.
Back when you first got to High Records and you were recording and producing instrumentals, what was the record label like?
It was like two guys, myself and Ray Harris. That's what it was like. We'd stay there all night. We'd come up with something. We'd call Joe, and Joe said, he'd approve it, and he'd put it on the street.
Now, had you worked with recording technology before?
No, not really, no.
So did you teach yourself?
I taught myself, right.
Were there mistakes you made early on before you learned the ropes?
Well, I made mistakes, but I didn't make them once.
Well, what's one of the mistakes that you made?
Well, I told a guy once, I said, you know, you're a great producer, but you taught me more than anybody I've known. He said, what did I teach you? I said, you taught me not to never make a record like you make it.
What was the record?
I'm not going to tell you.
Was there a special way you had of miking Al Green's voice? And did you mic him any differently on Can't Get Next to You?
No. I had one mic, because DX77 mic I used on Al all the time. And I wouldn't let anybody else use the mic. And I had a setting on it. I'd keep it there all the time. And it's the mic he sang all of his records on.
Trumpeter and record producer Willie Mitchell speaking to Terry Gross in 1995. He died yesterday at age 81.